The Future of Power, der Geopolitik-Podcast von Agora Strategy.
Herzlich willkommen zur 14. Episode des Podcasts The Future of Power, der Geopolitik-Podcast von Agora Strategy. Mein Name ist Timo Blenk, ich bin Partner und CEO der Agora Strategy Group und heute habe ich einen sehr besonderen Gast mit Dr. Parag Khanna und wir machen eine Special Edition in Englisch. Dear Parag, thank you so much for taking the time and welcome to our podcast.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
Today's topic is an Asian perspective on global climate and geopolitics. We'll talk about, global geopolitics, geography, but we will also zoom in the second half of the podcast a bit more on Asia, India, and current developments in the region. So before we jump into the topic, let me just briefly introduce you to our listeners. Parag, you are a well-known academic. You've published several books on global geopolitics, on climate, and on basically global change. You're currently writing the 8th book, and we're very much looking forward to that. You hold degrees in international relations and security studies from Georgetown University in the US, but you also have a PhD from the London School of Economics and International Relations. And you are the founder and CEO of the AI-powered global investment platform Climate Alpha. And you're also founder and managing partner of the strategic advisory firm Future Map. And in these roles, of course, you engage a lot with companies, you engage a lot with governments, so you know both sides. And you are also somebody who lived in very different countries. You've spent some time in Germany, but also India, Singapore, the United Arab Emirates, and the United States. So we're very much looking forward to our discussion today. And I've just highlighted a few points of your work and your background. So Parag, maybe if you can also elaborate a bit on that and share with us some more pieces of information on what you're doing. So please, over to you.
Sure. Danke, Timo. So it's a pleasure to see you and delighted to engage in this conversation. I actually was born in India, but I didn't spend a lot of time there. I spent my childhood in the United Arab Emirates, in New York and in Germany, and studied US, UK, lived in Switzerland, in the UK again, and then now in Singapore. So you could say a global citizen. That's the theme of my next book. It won't come out for a while, so let's not talk about that one today. But I have had partially a traditional academic path, but interrupted very fruitfully by writing books, traveling a lot, working with the US government, Defense Department in particular, doing a lot of advisory work for global corporations, and launching my own companies, all of which really roll up to the same fundamental concepts of geography. Even my AI company, Climate Alpha, is being renamed Alpha Geo, just to emphasize that it's not really just climate. You know, all of my work, the common thread is geography and the complexity of geography. So you might say where complexity, and complexity is probably a very important keyword for us today, where you have to grapple with economics, geopolitics, climate, social and demographic trends, technology, all at the same time colliding with each other. The collision of those often contradictory megatrends that produces that complexity and its impact on geography is fundamentally what all of my work is about. And it doesn't matter if it's academic, policy, or corporate, that is the area in which I feel most comfortable.
So maybe let's get started really on that topic. When you look at the current geography of the world, and we also look on mega trends like demography, of course, but mostly climate change, in your assessment, who will really be the countries profiting maybe, and which regions or also countries will be in trouble? So how's your view, of course, on that, also with an outside perspective on the US and most particularly also Germany and Europe?
It's fundamentally a question of regions rather than nations. You know, that's also something, again, that's fundamentally geopolitical. In proper geopolitics, you don't really focus on the sovereign state. You focus on geography, and the geography could be the scale of a city. If you're thinking about the spatial economics and power dynamics of a city versus its surrounding regions or the nation that its home, or if you're focusing at the continental scale or global scale. So it's never really about the present borders of nations. After all, we've only had the present borders of nations really in recent decades solidify, whereas we've had geopolitics since time, you know, immemorial. In terms of the mega trends that I've added on to the traditional geopolitical logic of competition when it comes to either the geographical size, the resource potential and endowments, the military factors, the demographic cohesion, the economic foundations and industrial base, all of those things are very typical in geopolitical calculus. There are two things that we have to bring either new or back into the picture, and those have been central to my recent work and to answering your question. And they are exactly, as you said, demographics and climate. Now, on demographics, the key insight is that the world population is beginning to plateau. We are reaching peak humanity, as scholars began to call it already 15, 20 years ago, as they forecast that the world population would not be 15 billion, but more like 13 billion, 12 billion, 11 billion, 10 billion. In fact, now, especially after COVID, because COVID was such a crash in fertility, we now estimate that the world population will not even reach 10 billion people, perhaps not even that close to 10 billion people. So we already are living in a world where the largest maximum number of human beings that will ever be alive at the same time, you know, we've almost arrived at that point. Of course, in many countries, particularly in the OECD countries, North America, Europe, and East Asia, that number is already declining, if not for immigration, given high mortality and low fertility and so forth. So if you take all of that together, suddenly demographics comes back into geopolitics, because as the geopolitical scholars of the 19th century knew, population base and population momentum, energy, is a key factor in geopolitical strength. The way I would frame is it in the 21st century is that collecting people is collecting power. Because gone are the days, and this was a particularly in the 20th century and maybe the 19th century, where you could presume that because the world population was growing, every generation would be larger than the one before it. And if a nation was losing people to emigration, it would still give rise to a larger population nonetheless. That is no longer true. When people leave Italy today or Russia today, that is a zero-sum picture. The population is materially declining. The integer is going down in value. And so you have a situation where one country's loss is another country's gain. Demographics is literally becoming zero sum, and it is better to be a country that has people than not to have people. And you only appreciate that when you are losing people. And of course, we're in a situation where some of the countries that are gaining people don't necessarily want all those people. And Germany is a case in point if you think about cultural assimilation issues, America as well. But big picture, better to be collecting people than not collecting people when the world population plateaus. And that is something that really no one alive today has any personal experience with. No one alive today has ever spoken to a human being who was alive at a time when the world population was not going like this. And therefore, to suddenly be in a world where the world population is stagnating and will soon decline is really uncharted territory, but it is intensely geopolitical. And just quickly on climate change, of course, this is happening at the same time. And climate change has global consequences, global effects, but very, very uneven and at different time scales. Generally speaking, climate change is going to affect the South or the Southern Hemisphere or the continents of Africa and South America in a much more pernicious way than the Northern Hemisphere. Now, most of the world population does live in the Northern Hemisphere, the Eurasian, mega continent and the North American continent. Africa has more people than North America, but it is geographically, geologically more circumscribed. So I am looking at the ways in which the demographic imbalances in the world, combined with the political environment in terms of proximity, politically, migration friendliness, and climate as a driver of migration will come together. And I'm making forecasts within and across the regions of the world to predict which regions and which countries are most likely to collect the most new residents, desirable or not, in the future, and whether or not they harness them will play into whether or not those countries increase or decrease in power in the future. So that's just a big picture way of looking at how demographics and climate come into geopolitics in the future. But there's, of course, a lot more to say.
So thank you very much for this big picture. So following up on this line of thoughts and this line of understanding of the current developments, my takeaway is that first, the basic assumption, the world population is growing, and but resources of the continent of the world are limited, is not going to hold for much longer. And in this regard, do you see a stronger mobility movement from the southern hemisphere to the northern hemisphere, or in your assessment, will just the balances change, and regions like the European Union, if they don't adapt quickly enough regarding migration, are going to fail as a global power or lose influence at least?
We can clearly see the thrust in terms of south to north migration as a major vector. And that's not only between continents such as South America to North America, but also Africa to Europe. We can also see it within particular continental land masses. You can see the movement of Asians within Asia, Asians to Europe as well. Europe is no doubt a growing collection point, you might say, for migrations and for vectors that we've really never experienced before in world history. This volume and scale and speed and intensity of Arab populations, African populations, and Central and South and East Asian populations into Europe is really quite remarkable. And of course, Europe is having a hard time in integrating those populations. It doesn't have the Anglo-American history of mass assimilation over the 19th and 20th centuries. And yet, if you compare to just 20 or 30 years ago, some European countries, such as Germany in particular, are doing a better job of it than one would have thought. I think everyone my age will remember the famous phrase. I think it was a German politician, Jürgen Rutger, or Norbert, who said Kinder statt Inder, right? And so one of the things I looked at in my recent research was, well, wie viele Kinder gibt es in der Tat in eigentlich in Deutschland, right? So I was like, oh my goodness, there's, we're a couple of years away from there being more Indian, ethnic Indian residents of Germany than children born to ethnic Germans in Germany. And so in a way, it failed, right? There's more Inder than Kinder soon enough. So of course, in the fastest growing fertility rates are among migrant populations. And yet, despite the AfD party and so forth, you still have a fundamental stability in the German polity over this issue. Significant reforms, of course, in the citizenship laws and these kinds of things that have been happening in Germany. So I do think that this phenomenon of, die neuen Deutschen, is playing out in a generally acceptable, and progressive way. And I think that other countries can learn from that, even though it's uncharted territory and it's very difficult. And again, those of us who were teenagers in Germany in the 1990s can remember that there were parties that were much more troublesome than the AfD is from a ideological standpoint. There was the NPD, for example, in the 90s that I remember prancing around East Berlin. There were actually areas I was afraid to go. I wouldn't say that today about the AfD. I wouldn't be afraid to talk to or confront a politician from the AfD. So getting into a bit of detail there, but I think overall, the most important thing to remember is there is politics and the rhetoric of leaders who may be xenophobic, racist, nationalist, anti-immigrant. And then there's the empirical reality of the numbers. And to be very, very clear, whether it is Le Pen, whether it is Geert Wilders, whether it is Giorgia Meloni, whether it is the AfD, it does not matter. What you consistently see year after year after year after year is that the actual number of migrants, legal, illegal, skilled, unskilled, keeps on going up. So again, as an analyst, you should always focus on the actual reality, not just the rhetoric. And it points to, again, Europe, just one region in particular, with a very fast growing migrant population. And that is can be a source of strength. But as we know, the ground reality depends very much on where you are. This is why cities that harness migrant inflows will ultimately succeed more than cities or regions or provinces or nations that do not. So if you look at the cities in Europe where you have fast growing migrant populations and maintain that stability and that absorption, right, those places succeed. That could be Berlin, that could be entire countries like Switzerland, which are of course very, very selective about which migrants can come in, or it can be cities like Milan versus regions like Southern Italy, right? So you see these spatial dynamics shifting, and that too is fundamentally geopolitics as well, because we are entering a world in which you have devolution, growing fragmentation, and these tendencies where the political units that matter in terms of those that have the most authority are not necessarily just the sovereign nation states as we define them today.
When we look on the government side of that, so in terms of, for example, path dependencies in the US and the German democracy, you often have established rules, procedures, and it's hard sometimes for policymakers to break out of these path dependencies and adapt to actually a changing world. As from an outside perspective, we could say, okay, things are changing. We need to embrace new data, the analysis, and change quickly. And governance structures often have troubles changing or shifting that quickly. So in your view, is this happening fast enough, taking the example of Germany or the US or other countries like, for example, the government in Singapore, Asian countries, Middle East countries, quicker in acting?
Mm-hmm. Well, perhaps the gold standard in this regard would be the United Arab Emirates, because it has a very unique, particular experience. Now, of course, it's not replicable and won't be replicated in other places. But just so that people have a benchmark in their minds, this is a country whose population is the fastest growing in the history of the world. So no country ever has grown from 200,000 people at independence 50 years ago in the early 1970s to 12 million people today. So that's a 60-fold increase in its own population. Of course, the indigenous Emirati population is less than 10%. So this is the most nationally diluted country that has ever existed. And yet, of course, owing to the fact that it is a monarchy, is effectively acts very much as a transnational, interregional commercial agglomeration of merchants from everywhere, it has devised a strategy to harness this potential, this manpower in a way, this labor force, to serve its national interests as defined by building demographic connectivity with the rest of the world. So that's really up here. And countries like Singapore are, you know, in a slightly lower tier. There's a very large indigenous population. It's more homogenous in terms of being Chinese primarily, with a lot of Indians and Malaysians and so forth as well. But if you look at and then you have the Anglophone countries, the United States, Canada, UK, Australia, in those countries, you do have a very substantial increase in the percentage of the population that is foreign born or of foreign ethnic origin. And there, those percentages are rising towards anywhere from 20 to 30%. And again, they're doing a much better job than the European, more historically homogenous, ethnically homogenous nation states of the past. But again, even there, you're seeing significantly more dilution than you would have expected 20, 30 years ago. And I think countries are realizing, governments are realizing, they do not have a choice. They do not have a choice from the standpoint of their labor force and to maintain their fiscal health and balance and all of these other things. So what I have not heard European leaders say forthright is we have no choice but to pursue a strategy of very active, proactive absorption, integration, assimilation of migrant populations, because our fertility rates are so low, beyond the point of no return. We have staggeringly high public debt. We have a major need to provide for caregivers, elderly care, basic jobs in the services economy and the goods and manufacturing economy, and even agriculture, and we do not have the manpower or the talent to do it. I don't hear any politicians simply coming out and saying it in Europe the way they need to say it. I certainly have a lot of sympathy with, whether it's not that it's just conservative politicians, I have sympathy with the ethos that says there used to be this predictability, stability, comfort, and comity with knowing what it is that German society is. Again, I've lived in Germany during that time when it was very clear what Germanness is and who Germans were. And I understand that there's concerns about security, about cultural integrity, and all of these things. So I don't think that there is just one correct answer for, treating this as a culturally neutral landscape where there's no space for that desire to have common identity. I don't deny the need for and desire for that nostalgia, right? I think it's actually very important. And so each country will move at a different pace towards that truth that migration and assimilation are absolutely paramount strategically, but it will depend on their cultural evolution. And again, I applaud Germany for just being more culturally evolved. And that's based on a certain cultural confidence. It takes a confidence to say, we can let them in and die Neuen Deutschen will become more like Germanness, than taking or hijacking the national identity. And I wish simply that more European countries could develop that confidence.
So, thank you for this, tour d'horizon through the world, and especially your assessment on Germany from the outside. Speaking of moving forward, and we've talked briefly about the US, but if we think about different paces, you could always imagine that a country is also going back, and having the elections in the US in November of this year, with potentially Trump coming back, and you've lived in the US, you know the country. You think there will be a strong cultural clash in the US, which actually is growing, or that a country which has been built on migration, like the United States, will always continue this path, but maybe the ethnic groups of migrants might change? Or how's a bit your look on the upcoming US elections, specifically with the scenario Trump coming back to office?
Well, fundamentally, the cultural clash or the growing divides over policies of race and immigration are very strong, and they've probably reached the point of no return in the sense that it's hard to imagine subcultures or geographies in the United States that are hyper-conservative, from turning back from those views against immigration anytime soon, and certainly not within this political cycle. So I do think that that is, that has become a litmus test and one of the key third rails, in the US election right now, among many, many other, challenges and tensions as well. On the Trump issue, I urge a lot of caution. I say this, very much as a political scientist rather than just focusing on this election. Anytime you're in a situation in any country where, the system is dependent upon a savior, or when the society is looking for a savior, a single person, one person or the other person, Biden or Trump, Obama or Trump, whatever the case may be, that is itself inherently dangerous. I'm a proponent of a school of thought known as technocracy, right? Leadership by meritocratic selection and a very strong independent civil service that fundamentally governs the society. There is still a strong scope for democratic input. You should have free and fair and frequent elections. I believe in universal participation in elections. I believe it should be mandatory for every adult age 16 and older to participate in democracy. This is a thoroughly consistent with democracy view. However, the governance and the execution, the administration of the public sector and the vision of the people, the will of the people, must be done by competent officials and executives. And that is not happening in many countries right now, right? And that is the problem. Again, I think that that Germany is an exception to the rule. The Anglo-American countries have kind of gone off the deep end right now in abandoning the commitment to actual functional governance. And that almost gives rise to the situation where, since you cannot rely on the state, you focus on the figure, on the individual, on the savior, whoever it may be, as controversial as it may be, someone like a Trump or otherwise. And that is, again, such a problematic situation to be in this political pendulum kind of dynamic rather than the state. I remember living in Berlin in 2017, 2018, when you had, a period of about 4 or 5 months without a government formation. And I was living in Berlin at the time, but of course the German state carries on. You cannot imagine that happening in the US or the UK, for example. So in a way, Germany is more technocratic than people realize because of the strength of the state institutions, the independent state institutions, and that's very important. So, to your point about Trump, I think again, the US had Trump once, it will have Trump, it might have Trump again. If it does have Trump again, then, again, the state, the nation survives in some way. It certainly is derailed or delayed from the kind of progress that it could be making collectively, because it will obviously further divide society. It will probably further accelerate the federalist trend in any case towards certain states really acting in autonomous ways, setting their own laws on things like abortion, on migrant rights, tax policy, climate policy, many of those things, labor policy, a lot of these things will continue to fragment. But fundamentally, if you want to tie it to issues of migration, remember that even in the most conservative places, the percentage of the population that is foreign is growing, right? It cannot be stopped. This is irrevocable. And secondly, some of the most conservative states, particularly the South and the West, are among the most hard hit by climate change. And so you will inevitably, and in geopolitics, you can speak in decades long timescales, you will probably have states of the northern regions of the US be more, sort of benefiting, if you will, from climate change and absorbing greater or larger populations. And many of those states at the moment tend to be governed by the Democratic Party.
Yeah. We've talked about mega trends at the start of this podcast episode, talked about demography, climate, geopolitics, of course. One mega trend, at least throughout the last year, seems to be conflict and global conflict. So just looking on the last 10 years, the number of roughly 33 conflicts at global scale has increased up to 55. This year, with also the average time of conflicts growing. So if we have these developments with, for example, Trump coming back to office and more radical parties, be it in Europe from the far right or in the US, the conservatives coming to power, do you see this conflict trend continuing and actually becoming at a certain point very uncalculable or very hard to predict in terms of what is happening, where is something happening? Do we have an explosive mix sometimes in the US towards other global powers? Or considering your assessment of global climate and demography data, this trend would actually be reversed with the world and maybe different countries taking or regions taking more care of themselves, but having less interactions among themselves also thinking of the keywords deglobalization, which seems at least to be considered in some parts of the world. So how's your take a bit on that?
I do certainly see a trend towards regionalism, and this is something that I've not necessarily been a proponent of, though I am to some degree, but that I've been analyzing for about 20 years, you know, and I've always felt that in international relations, we do focus too much on the level of the nation state and too little on the level of the region. But now the data is very clear that North American countries trade more with each other than they do with China, for example. They each have each other as the largest trading partner. Europe, that was always the case, I mean, in recent decades. Asian countries too, that's been true for about 10 or 15 years. So clearly the three pillars of the world economy, North America, Europe, and Asia, are increasingly intense in their systemic intra-system dynamics. And that's clearly a geopolitical megatrend. And I don't think that will be reversed, not least as a result of either cost pressures, geopolitical pressures, mistrust, you know, automation of labor. Many, many factors are driving that. That said, I do not believe in deglobalization because the total volume of trade is still rising. Global capital flows are very high. Global migration is high. Global digital connectivity and the services trade are very high and growing significantly, and so on and so forth. So the volumes of inter-regional flows across all categories of flows, goods, technology, people, talent, labor, whatever the case may be, digital finance, are all extraordinarily high. So to speak of deglobalization is really a really misleading myth. Whereas, again, it's always patterns of reglobalization and new vectors of globalization, perhaps replacing or substituting for previous ones. But it's not actually deglobalization per se, so long as you have a growing pie, such as the world economy is in fact growing. So let's not focus on that, but let's focus on these regional dynamics. And then therefore, the more retrenchment you have into that regional level, potentially you have less incentive for there to be intervention, interference, conflicts in other spheres of influence, right? That said, we are obviously in a transition phase where even if America could feel perfectly secure and self-sufficient and autonomous and autarkic in its own North American domain, it still has legacy obligations, commitments, desires, ambitions to either be an arbiter, a policeman, a reliable ally, or a guarantor of freedom of navigation, freedom of the seas, and so forth in other parts of the world. And that therefore means that there are still these frictions between the old era of global commitments and the new era of regional preferences. And so that's part of what makes the situations the situation in Asia so tense, because you have China rising in its desire to assert itself in its so-called sphere of influence. I do think, though, that you can have an equilibrium, and an equilibrium is really one of the most important concepts in geopolitics, right? It could be a unipolar order and a stability that is maintained during a unipolar system, or you can have a multipolar, multi-regional, multi-civilizational order of distributed power and have something of a dynamic equilibrium among them, right? That can be stable, it can even be peaceful. I think we want to have our eye on that, right? That is my aspiration. It's what I devote maybe my normative, you know, geopolitical work to arguing for, is a division of labor, what I call a global strategy, not just grand strategy. Every superpower has a grand strategy. A global strategy would be a common denominator among those grand strategies where they agree in principle and in practice that they want to work together on areas like stabilizing conflict zones, confronting climate change, managing migration, keeping a global trade open to a certain degree, and so on and so on. So to me, there is a global strategic agenda, even amidst strategic rivalry.
You already mentioned Asia-Pacific region, and most likely the South China Sea. There we really see this global power competition, at least between the US and China. And you're much, much closer to the region than we are. If you just zoom in a bit on the South China Sea and give us a bit, as a political scientist, your perspective on what is actually happening there, what are actually current ways of strategic rivalry. We always look, of course, on the US and China, but there are also other powers in the regions, like, for example, Japan. The Philippines had several clashes with their navy, with Chinese vessels. So it seems a bit from the outside, a bit like an explosive mix, at least somehow. And China, of course, is gaining global influence and wants to take their key place as a global power. So does it come in a more balanced way, or you really see that this is something we should, to use your words, keep our eye on to know what's going on?
I think the South China Sea is a really good example of course, a conflicted region, a tense region that is searching for an equilibrium, and we don't know what it's going to be. But we do know which approaches or assumptions have been wrong in the last 10 to 15 years. A couple of examples that would be the notion that this will simply become a Chinese lake, a zone of unipolar hegemony, and a Chinese equivalent of the Monroe Doctrine. That is not what is going to happen. Secondly, it's also been incorrect that the fate of the region will be determined purely by the outcome of the US-China rivalry, to the extent that there is ever going to be such a clear outcome, whether in Asia or globally. Instead, what we find is that it's much more fluid as a region. And today, you would characterize it as one that is increasingly multipolar. The United States has successfully brought together, well, it was others' idea, but the US has been a very strong proponent and convener of the Quad set of countries, whether it is in, together with India, Japan, and Australia, and secondary powers that are associated with the Quad, whether it is South Korea, Philippines, Vietnam, and Indonesia. And the Quad members have provided very significant capability, support, and in a way, just confidence diplomatically and strategically for those states to stand up to China. And in doing so, I think they've set a very good example for how one manages China's rise in a way where, despite its power, it doesn't simply get to call all the shots. And I think that the last couple of years have been characterized by China being somewhat taken aback and perhaps learning some lessons from the fact that many countries, despite their power asymmetry and relative weakness vis-a-vis China, are in fact, quote unquote, standing up. And in doing so, whether alone or together, that gives a hint that even a region, and even despite China's very, you know, stratospheric meteoric rise, you can have this region remain multipolar. I have long argued that Asia is a multipolar region in a multipolar world. Asia has been principally characterized by multipolarity for about 4,000 years. Asian civilizational diversity is such that it is almost inconceivable that any one power would actually be able to generally be a hegemonic power in all of Asia, the way that, the Mongol Empire was, and even that wasn't all of Asia. When people look to the Chinese dynastic tradition of the tributary system, they are really referring to an extremely narrow set of geographies in a very limited time period, which will really never repeat itself. So you have to think of Asia as being multipolar with China, Japan, India, Australia, Russia is an Asian power as well, and then external parties such as the United States. So truly a multipolar region in a multipolar world. And my firmest belief in the context of also, you know, being an advocate for global equilibrium is that Asia maintain that multipolar equilibrium that has characterized the vast majority of its history. So it is very well known and appreciated and generally accepted by Asians that there are limits to the extent to which they can genuinely dominate over others. And I feel that Asians inherently understand this. And therefore, from a theoretical standpoint, the application of Western models of polarity and global dynamics onto the Asian geography is really, really a misapplication, you know, of theory. And it really has led many, many scholars astray over the last 25, 30 years as they've been looking at models for the geopolitical dynamics of post-Cold War Asia. And instead, they should really always have been looking at Asia from the inside out rather than the outside in. And in the last 10 years that I've spent, you know, living here in the region, that has really struck me as a very clear truth.
We're coming slowly but steadily to the end of the podcast session. Just 2 points towards the end. The first one as you were also born in India, and India seems to be one of the rising stars at a global scale. What's your take currently on India, also a subcontinent heavily impacted by climate change? So will India be one of the key global powers, at least in the region, but most likely also in the world? And what is a bit their political stand in your perspective?
Well, India is, of course, growing very quickly. It's certainly the fastest growing, large economy in the world, but it still punches below its weight from a geostrategic standpoint, even as a nuclear power with large military. But that doesn't matter. Again, we shouldn't be measuring India in terms of its global power, but rather its influence in Asia, because Asia is the principal geopolitical theater. It doesn't really matter if India is influential in South America, does it? Right? It doesn't really matter. What matters much more is India's role in the greater Indian Ocean region, or what scholars and historians call Afro-Eurasia, right? Mm-hmm. The maritime and terrestrial domain linking Europe, East Asia, South Asia, Africa. And India, as the dominant power bestriding the Indian Ocean, is obviously a very, very key arbiter there. 20 years ago, US military officials wanted to project onto India a role as a continental military, terrestrial balancer in Eurasia to China. India has chosen not to play that role because it can't, because of the hostility with its neighbors, the geographical boundaries of the Himalayan mountain region. Instead, India invested very heavily in its navy, and we're clearly see that that is paying off. The Indian Ocean is not going to be renamed the Southwestern Chinese Ocean anytime soon, really never. It is the Indian Ocean for very good reason. So I think in that sense, India is starting to, fulfill its geopolitical destiny in that Afro-Eurasian Indian Ocean maritime space, and doing so quite successfully. It's really attracting global supply chains and investment. But yes, among the major red flags, beyond, of course, the demographic demands of having to absorb such a fast growing young population into the economy, is climate change. And so, if you look at regions of the world measured by the future climate stress from rising temperatures and the number of people affected by those rising temperatures, and the lack of adaptation towards climate change, India is very, very stressed. And South Asia as a whole is very, very stressed. And that is the most populous region of the entire world, just so that everyone is clear, across Pakistan, India, Bangladesh, the principal nations of South Asia, you have about 1.8 billion people. So this is by far the most populous region of the entire world. And it's also among the most climate stressed. So I do think that individually and collectively, a lot more will have to be done there around managing flooding, drought, sea level rise, hurricanes, and so forth. And that is not yet being done. One of the consequences, by the way, to bring it back to demographics, is that it means that many more Indians, in addition to, again, given the demographic drivers and the labor market drivers, but there's also the climate drivers and political drivers of outward migration. And India is the largest single source of emigrants in the entire world by this much, by a very, very wide margin. And that has been true for several years. I think it will be true for our entire lifetime. India will continue to export that many people or more. And therefore, what you're finding more and more is that Indians are preferred as migrants in many societies, because actually not just their geopolitical orientation or lack of a kind of threatening nature in Western societies, but also the fact that they can be Anglophone and have studied nursing or IT or other skills in which they're precisely those areas where you have deficits in Europe. So for many reasons, Indians are growing in population around the world. So the Indian diaspora is becoming something of a diplomatic and commercial force multiplier for India to help it achieve its geopolitical weight.
All right. So we've jumped a bit around the globe. So probably the last question, we talked about your background as a global citizen. So if you're going to open up another company in 15 years and taking all data and developments into account, where would you open up your next company, and would you also be willing to live there in that country?
Well, I get asked this question a lot in a different guise. People simply ask, where will you retire? And I'm remarkably consistent in this answer.
You will not retire, I have no doubts. You will always have something to do, no worries.
I won't retire, but it's effectively the same question since I won't retire. And the answer has always been Berlin. It has always been Berlin. I've written it, I've said it. Ich bin Berliner. I'm going to always be Berliner. So I hope that your audience in particular feels reassured by that sentiment. And I think that, again, you know, when you put all of the trends together, we started by talking about complexity. How do you determine winners and losers in a future where you have to balance and juggle geopolitics, demographics, economics, technology, climate, all at the same time? I came to the conclusion that the countries that are and cities that are absorbing young people will be the winners. Young people want to be there. Young people have options in the global geographical marketplace. And young people today are choosing Dubai, Berlin, Toronto, and Almaty, Kazakhstan, and Singapore, and so forth. So where you see young people congregating today, you can be very confident that those are the winning societies, whether it is the nation or the province or the city of the future. So I'm very pleased to see my Berlin, you know, the city I've known since Die Wende, you know, a place that is become such a cosmopolitan, you know, melting pot, and really emerging as not just a national capital, but a global capital.
Barak, thank you so much. My heart cries a bit because we're a Munich company and based in Munich, but Berlin is always very nice to spend some time. And the Agora Berlin team will be very happy to hear that, actually. So thank you so much for taking the time. Very much appreciated.
Pleasure.
And I hope we'll have a chance to continue that in a year to see where does scenario planning stand, where is your assessment in the future. And I also thank our listeners for tuning in. And the next episode, as always, will follow in a few weeks. Then again in German. Thank you so much.